So today I'm going to talk about weight zero MV cycles and equivariant multiples. And this is currently on the archive. And before I start writing more, I should say sort of what my overall goals are. Beyond just this work is first to compare MV basis, the Mirkovich-Volonen basis, to other bases. This is some method to see something about MV basis. And the story I'll talk about today, it's closely related to orbital varieties in the nilpotent cone. And sort of something I'm interested in is to sort of generalize the story about orbital varieties to some other symplectic resolutions and sort of I'll say something about this classical story about orbital varieties. It's very nice, and I would like to understand what's actually happening. Anyway, but to focus, let's start with affine Grassmannians. And geometric Sakai. So I'll say very little about this, just kind of recollection. So I have G, B, U, T, a complex reductive group with fixed Borel, torus, and U as its unipotent radical. I have O, which is the ring of Laurent series, the ring of power series, K, the ring of Laurent series. And you can form the affine Grassmannian so this, as I said, it is just a set, but it has a structure of an N scheme. So it's some object of infinite dimensional algebraic geometry, but very mildly so. And the object that people are interested in terms of geometric satake, is this thing called satake category, which is the category of equivariant perverse sheaves on this mildly infinite dimensional object. And the theorem, due to Mirkovich and Volonen, at least I will want their version of it, is that this geometrically defined category has a tensor structure and its tensor equivalent to the following algebraic category. Which is the category representations for the Langlands dual group. And the key feature. So they prove this, and one part of their proof is something called weight functors. So on this side, you can decompose a representation under the torus action into torus weight spaces. And what they show is how to explicitly realize the weight functors on this geometric side. And I'll say in the very special case when we take inside of here a irreducible representation with some highest weight lambda, they give a explicit vector space, geometrically defined vector space, that is this weight space. So let me say what this is. So we have lambda, a dominant co-weight, which by the way means that it's a dominant weight of G dual, and mu any co-weight. So they look at B lambda, look at its mu weight space, and they give this is the mu weight space. And they so say the following, that you can realize this weight space geometrically
using the following objects. So they define girl lambda, which is this. Well, I'm going to focus on SLN later. So a dominant coweight means some list of integers that are decreasing. So T to the lambda is just the element of G of K, that is that diagonal matrix whose diagonal entries are T to the power of those integers. So this would be something like T to the lambda 1, T to the lambda 2. So there's this space, and then there's this space. And what Merkovich and Vlonin prove is that there exists a canonical isomorphism between this weight space and the top dimensional compactly supported cohomology of this intersection. So some facts is this intersection is equidimensional. Since it's a top dimensional compactly supported cohomology, this has a basis given by irreducible components. So these irreducible components are called MB cycles. The basis is the MB basis.
Do you mean girl lambda or do you mean this one?
Sorry?
Do you literally mean girl lambda or do you mean the
compactification? It'll be the same. It'll be the same. So yeah, I mean, actually, maybe I'll just put that there for now because I will actually want the compactifications. So for this talk, I want to focus on the case of mu equal 0. And then we're looking at the zero weight space of a module. And we always have a Weyl group action on the zero weight space of an integral module. So therefore, W acts on this top dimensional compactly supported cohomology. And the goal is to understand something about this MB basis and this W action. Any questions at this point? To make the main statements, I have to say a little bit about equivariant multiplicities. And so
maybe before you make the main statement, maybe this is just going to be the main statement, but can you just say a couple more words about what it means to understand this MB basis?
Here's some example of completely understanding is like to give a formula for it, some sort of explicit combinatorial formula. That's not what I would do. But what I will say in the special case is the action here is quite mysterious from this Merkovich-Vlonin picture. So for example, the way they construct it, they use this Tanakian formalism. So they kind of abstractly construct a category, show that it's representations of a group. And in particular, it's different from other constructions in geometric representation theory, where you write down the Chevalier generators geometrically. So for example, even understanding somehow on the level of this kind of lighter geometric representation theory would be, for me, some sort of understanding, sort of some explicit sort of intersection theory. Because the way geometric Satake is defined, it's not explicitly any sort of intersection theory. So that would be some sort of answer that's not a full combinatorial understanding, but somewhere better.
And you're going to give some simple examples.
I'll talk about, so the example I'll talk about will all fit into the nilpotent cone for type A. So that's somewhat simpler. There'll be some matrices. Everything will be SLN. So, yes.
I don't really know this story. One version of Tanakian formalism doesn't really recover like a group of conjugation.
So there's this fiber functor, which is a what do you call it, hypercohomology.
So but I like What I'm trying to ask is, do I really get G-check on the nose, or do I get somehow G-check up by somewhere?
You get G-check on the nose because I don't know what the symmetric monoidal category is. Indeed, a group under up to isomorphism, it's sort of BG. And if you point, if you put a point on BG, then you get G. And that point on BG is a fiber functor. And you have a fiber functor, which is just hypercohomology. But it's a very important point. Like you have this. If you didn't have this, you would indeed only get a group up to isomorphism, up to sort of conjugation. Any other questions? Okay. So I want to talk about equivariant multiplicities in a kind of restricted setting where I have a affine T variety with a unique fixed point. And I'll make some further assumption that that X embeds inside of a vector space where T acts with all weights in a half space. This is not strictly necessary, but it'll be true for the example that we're going to look at. And what we want to define is some invariant of this singular point of this affine variety involving the torus action. And it's this relatively well-known object called the equivariant multiplicity. This is the T equivariant multiplicity of X at X. And where will it live? It will live in the fraction field of the T equivariant cohomology of a point. So this is just a polynomial ring, so a fraction field of polynomial ring. And the point I want to make is that you're probably familiar with this object from, say, the localization theorem, but it's also, in principle, a relatively computable object. So the first definition is you look at the inclusion of the T fixed points. This should be a little x. T fixed point, which is just one, maybe I'll just map. Inclusion of the equivariant cohomology of a fixed point into the whole space. And if I want to write down the class of the of X, then this will be equal to some rational function times the class of a point. And this will be equivariant multiplicity. So if X was a smooth point, then this thing is just 1 over the product of the weights of the tangent space of X. And with X is singular, this will be some more complicated rational function. And the second definition is sort of the computational definition, which is to compute the T equivariant Hilbert series of the coordinate ring of X and take leading term. So I don't want to say specifically what take leading term is. It's not very hard, but I'll say in sort of example. So if we're in the case of a smooth X with this little x non-singular, then when I compute the T equivariant Hilbert series, I'll just get something like this, product over 1. And then when I take leading term in this example, will mean this. And the other example is if I have 1 minus e plus alpha beta over 1 minus e to the alpha, 1 minus e to the beta. So for each of these, I expand them as a series in the argument. This will have alpha plus beta plus some higher power, so I'll just remember that leading term. And then for the denominator, same thing. This will just have alpha, and this will have beta. So I mean, I haven't told you precisely what to do, but there's a very easy procedure. That if you can compute the Hilbert series, you can compute this Hilbert equivariant multiplicity. And my point is that these objects are, you can compute them on a computer. They're not so bad. And if you know something about this variety, you could maybe try and attack this problem through like commutative algebra, combinatorial commutative algebra, something like this. So this was this small aside on equivariant multiplicities. And I need that to state my statements. I wasn't even close with. So here we have this W action on the top dimensional, I'll include this closure, compactly supported cohomology of this intersection. The dual of compactly supported cohomology is Borel-Moore homology, and I'll just consider the dual action. It'd be easier for stating things. And we have a map from this to the fraction field of the T-equivariant cohomology of a point, well, maybe of zero, but that's, sorry, it's actually a point, which is just take, this is the top dimensional Borel-Moore homology of this intersection. It has this basis given by cycles. So we take a cycle in there, take its fundamental class, and we just send it to its equivariant multiplicity at zero. So this is the example of my variety x with t action. Xx here has a unique fixed point zero. The weights will all fit into a half space. And so this is this. So the conjecture is that this map is W equivariant. So one of my goals was to publicize this conjecture and hopefully get a solution, and it's been successful because in the last week, actually, this has been proved by Kamnitzer, Knudsen, Beaumont, Kamnitzer, and Knudsen. And it fits into this big story that they have about Doistermont-Heckmann measures for MV cycles. And I think this has been a long project of theirs, so I hope it'll appear soon. So I've seen their, but I have a way of I stated this conjecture originally, and I had some sort of very hands-on type A dirty trick way of proving some cases. So that's what I will talk about today, that this is true for SLN and dominant coweights that are less than n times the first fundamental weight. And this method that I'll tell you, it's about more than just this W action, but one thing we'll do is it'll prove it in these cases. And for type A MV cycles, this map is actually generally not going to be injective. It will be injective in this special case, and that's something we'll use. So equivariant multiplicities don't separate MV cycles, but this sort of type A dirty trick will actually separate MV cycles, and sort of what it means is kind of mysterious. So the method of proof is sort of to go kind of move the problem around until you get to somewhere where you can solve it. So we have this MV basis. So now I'm focusing on SLN and, well, initially arbitrary lambda and then a second LL. So there's this work by Braverman
Gate Scory, and Vibranov are related this MV basis to another basis, which I will call the basis of big Spoltenstein varieties. And this was studied, there's a, by Braverman and Gatescore, if I've written the author down, I'll use an initial for them. They studied an action here, actually, their purpose was to actually study a different basis, a different construction, and so called little Spaltenstein varieties. I'll say what these mean a little bit later. And this action actually is perhaps more familiar to people. It's for example, described in this book by Chris and Ginsburg, which is maybe chapter 4 of that book, which is this Ginsburg action by convolution. And maybe I'll say some sort of facts that are known about this. So by a work of Alistair Savage, he proves that this basis, for example, agrees with the Nakajima basis. And so let me say very roughly, so there's this sheaf theoretic construction of geometric satake. And what Braverman and Gatescore do is they construct a sheaf theoretic action on big Spaltenstein varieties, and they prove that the Fourier transform of that is a sheaf theoretic action, or sort of an action of sheaf theoretic origin on little Spaltenstein varieties. And they state, but sort of the details aren't really kind of spelled out. The details are sort of, you can piece them together. Some work of Vassarow and Brunden and Ostrich. So sort of comparing sheaf theoretic constructions with convolution theoretic constructions. So the things in stars are things that I've done. Is that the sheaf theoretic construction can also be realized convolution theoretically. So I'll say a little bit more about each of these things as I go through them. So now I want to focus on the case of lambda less than or equal to n times the first fundamental weight and the zeroth weight. So then, if you actually look carefully at what happens in this Ginsburg construction in these two conditions, you will actually see that you'll get a Springer fiber, a usual full flag variety Springer fiber. So there's this well-known bijection between such dominant weights and partitions, it's a lambda transpose Springer fiber. And if you look through here, you'll actually see the same a different Springer fiber, the lambda Springer fiber, but tensored with the sine action. And it's well known that these two things will differ by a Fourier transform. So all these are some sheaf theoretic Fourier transform that's somewhat mysterious. And then the last part is then there's this work of Joseph, sort of conjecturally due to Joseph, and then finally proved by Hatta, which relates the Weyl group action on Springer fibers to these orbital varieties and equivariant multiplicities. So you kind of push through all of this, and then you see that the action on these weight zero MV cycles are given by a natural action on equivariant multiplicities. But you want to check that actually there's a very easy and elementary way to go from MV cycles of this form in orbital varieties, and it's a map due to Lustig, which is very kind of linear algebraic and straightforward. And you want to check that this complicated thing is the same, and I have to check that. So what I'm going to say in my talk is sort of the argument kind of goes through these various steps that are all very type A specific. And I want to say a little bit about these various steps. And I'll kind of focus very much on this part of the story.
There's this Braverman-Gates-Corey Vibhranov construction that compares the MV basis to this big Spaltenstein basis. So it's quite involved. So I just want to say sort of what are the key steps of it and sort of what are the non-trivial things that go into it. So there's this geometric realization of Schurweil duality. And then there's also some geometric realization of GLN-GLN duality, this kind of symmetric GLN-GLN duality. And I should say this geometric realization of Schurweil duality, it's spelled out in a lot of detail in some work of Mautner. And one reason why dualities are useful is that you've constructed some category of representations geometrically, and dualities construct modules and Hom spaces. So they sort of get some hope to see something more explicit. This symmetric GLN-GLN duality, the hard part is to identify the symmetric and symmetric power of CN tensor CN as a perverse sheaf. And that's some work of Braverman, Finkelberg, Gates-Corey, and Mirkovich. Okay, so they identify this perverse sheaf. They're able to write down some vector space that realizes these modules. And then the final ingredient is that they want to realize some Hom space, which is going to be some Hom between perverse sheaves. Usually that's not so geometric, but if the target of the Hom is actually a constant sheaf, so you want a Hom between a perverse sheaf and the push forward of a constant sheaf from something, then there's this this convolution theoretic way, well, maybe convolution theoretic. There's this geometric way to realize that Hom space. This is also sort of this general thing about it's discussed in this book by Chris Ginsburg, and the key thing is that the objects that you push forward are IC sheaves of these guys, and these guys are rationally smooth. So their IC sheaves are actually constant sheaves. So my point is just to say sort of what are the special things we're using to kind of move through. And then the answer is we're using a lot of special things. Okay, so but I won't say more about this, but except for these are sort of the key ingredients for transferring this problem into a problem about convolution, or I'm sorry, at least about big Spaltenstein varieties. Okay, so let me say something about now these two constructions on big and small Spaltenstein varieties. So now I have to fix this kind of tedious notation that if you've ever seen this construction by Ginsburg that you have to deal with. So the first thing is we fix two positive integers n and d, and then p and d is a set of n-step compositions of d. So there are n-tuples of non-negative integers whose sum up to d, not necessarily decreasing. And then given one of these compositions, you can form this flag variety. It's a partial flag variety inside of CD, where the dimensions of the pieces are controlled by this composition. And this is equal to G, which is for me GLN mod a parabolic. GLD, sorry. Okay. So you can take the Lie algebra of this parabolic, and UD inside of here is its nilpotent radical. And I'll write GD for GLD. And inside of GD, I will have the nilpotent cone. And inside of here, I'll have this restricted locus of nilpotent elements that actually their nth power is already zero. And then there's this parabolic version of the Springer resolution. So the basic idea is that we have this partial flag variety, we have its cotangent bundle, and there's a Springer map for that. And the little Spaltenstein varieties are precisely the fibers of this thing. So fix x in nd, sorry, in nd, nnd. And then this is by definition the little Spaltenstein fiber. So these are somewhat familiar.
The maybe slightly less familiar
object is sort of the big versions. It's just essentially the Grothendieck-Springer version of these.
We have this
GD.
Which is the,
sorry, this is a UD here. So here we built this vector bundle over this partial flag variety with fiber UD. This is same thing with fiber PD. Then you have the parabolic Grothendieck alteration. And then you can form these things. These are little Spaltenstein fibers. These are big Spaltenstein fibers. So I put up these notation, but I should just say, in words, all that we've done is we've fixed an nilpotent element, and we want, for the little Spaltenstein fibers, flags that are strictly preserved by the nilpotent, which is to say Fi gets mapped to Fi minus 1. And the big one is just weakly preserved, that Fi goes back to Fi. Okay. So consider the usual Grothendieck-Springer resolution. And there's this Grothendieck sheaf, which is defined as the push forward along this map of the constant sheaf. This map will have a W action, this usual story that this map is small, and that on the open locus it has a W action. And what you can do, how are we going to construct this GLN modules, is that you take E, which is CN, for simplicity, or sort of simplicity later, I will write it down as a sum of lines corresponding to standard bases. And for each of these compositions, I will write E D to be E1 to the D1, EN to the DN. So it's also some other line. And the fact is that if you take this Grothendieck sheaf and you tensor it with the dth power of this n-dimensional vector space, then you have a Weyl group action. Sorry, so this Weyl group is nothing mysterious, just the symmetric group on d letters. This SD acts here, SD also acts here by permuting the factors. GLE acts here. And if you take SD invariant, so the SD and the GLE are commuting, then this sheaf will have a GLE, which is just GLN action. Okay, but so far this is just the usual Grothendieck-Springer resolution.
Maybe I'll write it here, just so it's all here. So the theorem, due to Braverman and Gates-Gorey, is that they can identify these invariants very explicitly. That's just the sum over all compositions of these push forwards of parabolic push forwards along parabolic Grundig spring resolutions. So there are two sheaves here. So here we took this full flag variety Grundig spring resolution, tensored it with this guy, and took invariants. Here we are summing over each different one of these, and the point is that the fibers of these PD are these big Spaltenstein varieties. So out of this you'll get a GL in action on the direct sum of the cohomologies of these things. And the theorem they prove with Braverman, Gates-Gorey, and Vibernov is that this basis is the MV basis. And so let me write that here. So we have an action on this direct sum of sheaves, and when we look at fibers, we get this following fact. It's part of their theorem, is that you can realize, so you fix x in O lambda. So you can identify the nilpotent orbits inside of here with partitions of D with at most n parts, and they can be identified with dominant weights for GLN. So you fix x in one of these nilpotent orbits, and then you can realize V lambda as the direct sum over compositions of, so d lambda will be the dimension of this big Spaltenstein variety. So there's, because it's a sheaf theoretic construction, you can just take Fourier transform. And what you'll see, actually, if you Fourier transform the push forwards of these constant sheaves up here along this parabolic Grundig-Springer maps, is you'll get these. And it will kind of invert the it will send lambda transpose to lambda. So under Fourier transform of that sheaf, we also get a action on this. And this is this small Spaltenstein varieties. And the claim, which they make, but if you want to really carefully check, you have to look at some work of Vassaro and Brunnen and Ostrich, is that this action is the Ginzburg action. So what they were trying to do is, so Ginzburg wrote down this action on these spaces very explicitly in terms of correspondences, but it seems a little ad hoc. And so they wanted to give a kind of clean construction. But now what they've done is they've constructed a sheaf theoretic action on here. And so I can do kind of the backwards problem, which is to take this kind of invariant but somewhat mysterious sheaf theoretic action and say that this is given by some explicit convolution. So the action of Chevalier generators on this guy are given by convolution by explicit correspondences. And let me say sort of roughly how the proof goes is that so the proof, you have to analyze this isomorphism between the invariants and these guys very carefully. So what's going on here is actually a kind of a sheaf theoretic version
of Schur-Weil duality. So it's a general fact, if you take a SD module, not a sheaf, and tensor with E tensor D, take invariance, you have a version of this. And so you have to kind of study this carefully and then check check what happens when you act by Chevalier generators. The Chevalier generators are going to be built out of sort of the symmetric group actions. And you'll get a variation of some formulas of Bessereau. But then you want to check that it's the same as some convolution construction, and then you make a guess at what it is, and then you compare the two using the localization theorem. So I mean, currently it's sort of like kind of guess and check, but I wonder if there's a sort of more natural way to see this.
Sorry, just to make sure I don't get totally lost here, can you remind me what the statement of this theorem is in the case where n equals 1?
In the case when n equals 1.
And so it should be simpler to say in that case.
See, n equals 1, then n equals 1 is maybe a strange case. So n equals 1, we're going to be looking at one-step compositions of, maybe n equals 1 is very degenerate.
Maybe n equals d.
N equals d is the case I'm going to talk about, actually, so maybe I can. So for n equals 2, you'll see sort of this these guys. Yeah, maybe n equals 2 is not the case, I can say. So n equals 2, what you'll see here is these fibers will be Grassmannians, and you'll have a nilpotent operator, and you want invariant subspaces, the scheme of invariant subspaces. And those schemes of invariant subspaces will always have a single top-dimensional component. You'll have some smaller guys, and you'll see an SL2 action there. That's what's going on there. Okay. But the other case, which is n equals d, is what I'm going to do for the rest of the talk. So weight 0 and n equals d. So this corresponds to this condition of lambda less than the first fundamental. And so we have n equals d. The composition that corresponds to weight 0 in this case is what I'm calling 1 to the d, which is just the composition of d into d parts that are all 1. And then you can observe that the corresponding partial flag variety is just the full flag variety. And so what that says is that the zero weight space of this particular type of representation is identified with the top Brell-Moore homology of this. And this is this Fourier transform gives, you know, not an explicit but abstract isomorphism between the top Brell-Moore homology of this. Hereby, so x is in this nilpotent orbit, and x transpose is just something in the transpose nilpotent orbit. It's not a map. And observe that, so this is just what we would call a usual Springer fiber, variety of flags invariant under a nilpotent operator. And this, it's a special case where big and small are the same. So if you have a full flag, then being strongly invariant is the same as being weakly invariant. So this thing has a W action, and these also have W actions. And the theorem is that these two W actions agree. So instead of, and this is a statement that doesn't involve equivariant multiplicities. is that the two W actions on the top cohomology of these small Spaltenstein varieties, which in this case are just Springer fibers, the one action is coming from being the zero weight space of the Skinsberg construction. The other action is coming from the Fourier transform of this Braverman-Gates-Corey construction. They agree. And that the two W actions on this agree after tensoring with the sign representation. Sort of just, you can just check that you need to do that. That you can check that abstractly these two representations are not the same. They have to be tensored with a sign, but afterwards actually the bases agree. And so the corollary is that the MV basis for this particular case, so lambda less than or equal to n omega 1 and mu equals 0, is equal to the Springer basis tensored with a sign. And the same is actually true for Nakajima basis and Springer basis. That's also a corollary. So this Nakajima Ginsburg basis. For these special conditions. And the proof right here. Is that in general, you can write down a braid group action on a representation that on the zero weight space will descend to a Weyl group action. And those braid operators are expressed as exponentials and Chevalier generators. So in general, as the dominant weight gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you'll have to see more and more terms of this, right, on the braid group action. Because we're in a relatively small situation, if you expand this, only four terms will be relevant. And you can do some SL2 representation theory, actually reduce it to just this. And then you compute this using this convolution from the previous theorem. And you check that, in fact, for example, for Ginsburg's construction of the Springer representations, there's some convolution. You can check that this cycle is the same as that cycle. So actually, it's even true if you add sort of scaling equivariance, but that's not necessary for this. And the last part of the talk will be, so right now we're at this stage. We want to talk about this, how do we go to equivariant multiplicity. So there's this very nice story of how to go from Springer fibers to orbital varieties. Sort of relatively classical at this point, but I think somehow less well known than it should be, so I want to kind of recall the story. So take the usual Springer resolution. Inside of here, you can have a nilpotent orbit. Inside of there, we can take a point. And then we can look at the Springer fiber, which is just the preimage of that point under the Springer resolution, and we'll get a bunch of components. These Springer components. And I'm talking about type A. So just for concreteness, it's known that these components are actually indexed by standard Young tableau of shape lambda. So each standard Young tableau, you can get a component here. But on the other hand, you can do something else. You can take this nilpotent orbit, take its closure, and intersect it with strictly upper triangular matrices. These are a bunch of projective varieties. This is now an affine variety. It's a union. I'm going to disjoint union. Again, over pieces indexed by standard Young tableau. And what is the relation between the two of these? It's actually quite simple. Is that maybe I'll erase this word. Is that given a Springer component, you can form this associated quotient. So I'm in type A, where the I'll say GLN, where the centralizers are connected. I can form this associated quotient. G mod GX is isomorphic to O lambda. So it's a fiber bundle with fibers isomorphic to a Springer component. And the claim is that if you take the closure of this fiber bundle over the nilpotent orbit inside of the cotangent bundle to the flag variety, that this sits as an open dense into this other object, which is, now this is a bundle of cones over the flag variety. So this is somehow how you can at least realize combinatorially this association, that every Springer fiber, Springer component in type A corresponds to one of these orbital varieties. And so Joseph, he knew this. And he proved that the equivariant multiplicities of these orbital varieties are closed under W action. And at the time that he constructed this, the Springer representation was relatively mysterious. And he conjectured that actually, so now you have a W module and you have a collection of spanning vectors, that they're actually linearly independent, and that this basis is this basis of Springer components and Springer theory. And then Hotta proved this. So his proof is, there's this book by Borjo, Brilinski, McPherson, it's relatively old as well, that maybe has very good exposition of this, and in particular, they give a new proof of Hotta's theorem that really kind of studies the geometry of this picture. And so we see that, you know, the MV basis is the Springer basis. By Hotta's theorem, that Springer basis is actually the same as the basis of equivariant multiplicities. The one thing that might have gone wrong is that through this procedure, why do we know that the equivariant multiplicities of orbital varieties have anything to do with equivariant multiplicities of MV cycles? So that's the last thing I want to say, and then I'll finish. So I said at the beginning that sort of there's this kind of beautiful story of studying these Springer fibers. This basis is very mysterious. This is, you know, in general, for symplectic resolution, you don't have much control of this thing. But in this particular case, you can kind of see the W action and the basis in terms of sort of affine varieties. And as I mentioned at the very beginning, these things are not so hard to compute on a computer. So for example, writing some very naive program, I can do up to n equals 7, no problem. And being a little bit more clever, I think I can go maybe n 10 or 12 or something like this, at least an example. So it's much more computable than what you would guess if you try to write down the Springer basis.
Can you say how relevant it is? Those are the equivariant multiplicities of what?
So you took the strictly upper triangular matrices. Maybe I shouldn't have written on this board. Strictly upper triangular matrices and intersect with a nilpotent orbit closure. And that will be a union of components. In fact, these will be Lagrangian inside of here. And so you have a bunch of components. They're affine varieties. They live inside this ambient space. And it's just the equivariant multiplicity of that affine variety.
At zero.
At zero. Zero inside the Lie algebra. So what do the equivariant multiplicities of MB cycles have to do with orbital varieties? So the thing we need to do to wrap up. Is there's this classical map due to Lustig, which embeds the nilpotent cone inside of the affine Grassmannian. And the map is just take a nilpotent operator and send it to 1 minus x times t inverse, which is an element of SLN, k minus SLN O. So inside of here, we have U, which is upper triangular matrices, upper triangular nilpotent matrices. And this just maps to the intersection under Lustig's map with these guys, which is the type of set we want to look at. And the nilpotent orbits go to Gur lambda. So under this map, O lambda intersect U, it's just isomorphic as a variety to the space that we wanted to study. So the equivariant multiplicities are the same. And so in particular, it gives a very direct bijection of irreducible components. Just use the fact that they're isomorphic varieties. And the final thing you have to check is that this very straightforward bijection, so this is the, you know, ballistic bijection, and this is maybe the complicated bijection, they're the same. And this is really the point where you have to unpack this. So everything I said largely can kind of treat this as a black box, but this requires unpacking, and you'll see kind of these diagrams, and you'll have to check that it's the same as this. So I said at the very beginning that the thing I wanted to understand was bases, and so I have a question, which is the following. So we take x in nilpotent orbit, then we take h top of a Springer fiber, or we take h top of a Springer fiber in the transposed nilpotent orbit, and we tensor with a sign. So then, after tensoring with a sign, we see that there are two modules, and they're the same module as an abstract Weyl group module. And in particular, they both have bases. And you can also take the dual of this. So Weyl group modules are self-dual. So actually, we have four modules. And by what I said, these things will correspond to the dual or usual MV basis, or the dual or usual Nakajima basis. And so does anyone know an example where all four of these bases disagree? This is more a question about classical Springer theory. I can find some examples by computer check where like this and this disagree, which is, seems to point that it's the right thing. But in those cases, maybe like, this and this disagree, but this and this happen to agree. So anybody's sort of a natural question. But Springer theory, has everyone seen something about this? So maybe I'll just keep pushing with my computer and I'll find an example, which would show that. So I want to say MV basis is not the Nakajima basis. I can prove that these two are not the same. So the very naive guess is not the same. But I'm worried that, well, the answer will be like, oh, you're supposed to take dual. So I want a kind of a robust answer that they're just not the same basis. So as I mentioned at the very beginning, one thing I want to do is to advertise this conjecture. And I'm pretty happy that there's a solution. Their solution, I thought the solution would be would involve something like Goldie rank polynomials for truncated shifted Yangians. That's sort of the analog. There's a story due to Joseph, and he studied these things as sort of some analog of Goldie rank polynomials. And there's a precise relationship. And the fact that they're closed under W action is kind of just generalization of this proof for Goldie rank polynomials. So I thought that maybe the proof would involve those, but their proof is sort of just geometric. But I still think it would sort of be an interesting story to study, well, what are Goldie rank polynomials and what is their relationship to these equivariant multiplicities? And I think this is maybe, hopefully, a hint of sort of this general orbital variety story, sort of for affine Grassmannian slices, for example. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, I mean, we can tell you what the Goldie rank polynomials are.
Do you know them?
Yeah.
Do you know that there's a W action on them?
I mean, in principle, and this is one of these things where I am very sure we have all the ingredients. I don't know, somehow it would probably require a bit of work to pull them out. But I mean, implicit in this paper, our most recent paper on the archive are these Goldie rank polynomials.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would be very interested to see. I mean, you would want to say you have a how I thought this was going to be proved, which is not what Joel and Alan and Pierre Beaumont do, is that you would construct your kind of categorified action, and then you would see a action on Goldie rank polynomials of rank of zero, of weight zero, and then and just show that that's the same as the Satake action. That would be a way to prove this. And so it's probably true, but I don't know. Can you see those steps?
I mean, I think we have kind of the ingredients to it, especially in this type A case. Yeah, I mean, have the W action by these Chuang-Ruquier complexes,
which is like this triple exponential thing that I wrote down, right? Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'm interested. You should do it. Let's explain how it works.
Maybe I've asked this before, but is there some way to bootstrap like higher cases from all lambda?
So, this is actually an interesting story, is that these equivariant multiplicities for MB cycles, if you go, like we were talking yesterday, they don't separate MB cycles once you go big enough, so they part of their proof is they explain why it doesn't work. But you could do something else, which is forget about the MB story and just look at this story. And because this is, you just kind of, there's an analog of this Joseph Hatta story, where instead of so you have your x, which is in O lambda, which is now not a partition of n, but a partition of d with n parts, and then you intersect with pd. And so this is not Lagrangian in this thing, but you still have components, and there's bijection between these components and these components, and the classes of these will be. So I mean, part of this story, which I didn't say, is that there's this actually deeper thing than this sort of, formally you can actually get this using sort of some technology that, but the deeper statement is actually each of these Springer fibers, you can look at the corresponding Springer components, you can look at their harmonic polynomial. And the homology of this is in bijection with harmonic polynomials, and that harmonic polynomial is exactly the numerator of this, which is a little surprising. I think the same story we should hold here. So you'll get these classes, and then these will separate MB cycles, essentially kind of by construction. But this, the thing that happens in this small case is that this is exactly the MB intersection, and when you go beyond the small case, this is bigger. The MB intersection is a little too small. So you can, in type A, embed the entire story into some equivariant cohomology of different tori. Tori that get bigger as lambda gets bigger. And so, well, what about other types? I don't know. So like, if you want to compute with the MB basis in terms of intersection theory, this is a way to do it in type A, but not outside of type A that I know of.